You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 203.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. And of course, today I am joined by my co-host, Aaron. How are you doing today?
Glad to be here.
All right. So today we're going to talk about a topic, a country that came up a lot when I was on the air back in at Yale, because Iraq was always in the news at that time. It's funny how the whole Iraq thing has just dropped out of the news in the past 16 years or so.
Were we already in Iraq War II at that
point? Oh, yes. Very much so.
I know we talked about it on the 9/11 episode, but it's gotten fuzzy what the order of operations for. You know, where did we invade first after that, and how long were we there? And when were things spiking versus cooling down in the Middle East, various regions?
But yeah. Or sometimes I feel like it's more just spiking down in terms of like what the media is presenting to us. In some ways.
Oh, sure. But, yeah. The perception in America is correlated, but not a direct, direct representation of what's actually going on over there.
Well, we fought this whole war and they were like, we're going to bring democracy to Iraq. I'm not going to litigate that today, but I do want to talk about, I want to talk about it from more of like a mathematical standpoint and more of a social choice theory standpoint, because, and this is a new story that I think many people out there may not have heard of. The Iraqis recently had an election, and there have been changes in the Iraqi election law, and those changes provide a glimpse into social choice theory. They changed the way how the seats are allocated is calculated. And, you know, there are a bunch of articles came out. It's hard to tell whether it's been good or bad. Obviously, some people are complaining. Some people say it contributes to instability. But, you know, obviously you could say there's already been instability. On the other hand, surprisingly, this Iraqi constitution, which came into effect in 2005, is still in effect, which, is order of magnitude as long as any other government of Iraq has taken place. So, okay, yeah, I think...
Well, and not to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but the change... So the obvious parallel would be we talked a number of episodes back about changes to how elections were being done in New York State with ranked choice voting. This is a different kind of change, it sounds like. This is not a change to how the actual voting is done, but to how those votes are being... I guess how representation is being allocated. Do you know the voting system that they were using? Was it a standard, one person, one vote at the voting booth level, or was it a more complex system like ranked choice voting?
Yeah, no. So they don't have ranked choice voting, and I'll get into the changes in a little bit. But it's more like how the districts are drawn, and here in the U.S. we have single member districts, so. It's, you're in your congressional district and you elect one person from that district, whereas in Iraq and in many countries, particularly European countries, Middle Eastern countries, they do, they have multi-member districts.
The defining feature of a parliamentary system versus what we have, or is there more nuance to that?
It's more nuanced because in the UK, they have a single district constituencies, what they're called, constituencies. Single person, like they elect a single member of parliament from that constituency. So it's not uncommon. Then of course there are countries like Ukraine and like Israel that have one giant constituency and it's proportional representation from that. So a lot of things you can do. So first this is kind of crazy. I wanted to go over a brief history of Iraq and all the governments they've been through. I am not an expert on this. So I feel like we have to talk about it just to set the table here, but I also don't think that, if somebody knows more than this, more about this than me, feel free to, come in and yell at us, I guess.
let us know on the local.
Definitely on the local, because in the next few weeks, and Aaron will respond and answer for me. That's your job, okay? Okay, so Iraq. here's my take on it. After World War One, or before World War One, it was part of the Ottoman Empire, right?
Okay.
You know, they had probably, they had a few provinces that were, that became modern day Iraq, including, you know, Baghdad province, which probably had Baghdad in it, I'm sure. And, you know, Mesopotamia and all that. Okay. So then after World War One, all that collapses, the British and French come in, you know, because they're the victors. And
they divvy it up.
Iraq goes to the British. At first, they were going to try a mandate, like the mandate for Transjordan, mandate for Palestine. We'll do a mandate for Iraq, but that kind of fell apart very quickly. So they set up a kingdom there. And the borders of Iraq were kind of drawn in a way that was not very stable, because there's a lot of different ethnic groups there that have a problem you know, becoming kind of a unified nation.
It's the classic colonial conundrum that they've drawn lines on a map. They've grouped a bunch of peoples together who previously may have coexisted, but were somewhat independently operating, and now they're being expected to function like a nation state.
Sure, sure. And I'm sure that someone who really knows what's going on in Iraq probably has a lot more nuance to this. So anyway, the Kingdom of Iraq lasted for about 37 years. It was not very stable, but it's the most stable of any of the other ones that follow. So then it goes to the Iraqi Republic. So you had probably some democratic elections under the kingdom. I don't know if you had elections under the kingdom. You probably had a parliament under the kingdom.
The kingdom lasted from the interwar period through to into the post-war period.
I think in the 50s, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And that's when... you see, I'm already in danger of mixing my Middle Eastern countries, because I'm thinking of the Shah of Iran.
And right. That's
perhaps a very similar backstory in broad strokes, but different details there.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not going to pull up the exact dates. I think it was, if it was 37 years, I'm thinking from like 1921 to 1957. Something like that, 1958. Okay, so it becomes a republic. You know, now they have elections, and there's no king there to kind of, to kind of set policy. I'm actually not sure if there are elections under the kingdom, although many kingdoms that the British set up also have parliaments with elections. So anyway, the republic lasted for a certain period of time, and then you had the Ba'ath Party take over. And I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, because it's Ba'ath. They are kind of this, I hope I'm characterizing correctly, sort of a very authoritarian, very socialist, centralized economy. And they take over. And then the guy who was their main enforcer, who was doing all the purges and all the skull cracking, he ends up deposing the leader there, and then he himself becomes the dictator, and that, of course, is Saddam Hussein. He goes from, what, the late 70s all the way to 2003. There was the Gulf War in there. Kuwait, that was another thing with Iraq. Like, Kuwait had a lot of oil, and that's sort of why the British kind of had that, I think, before World War One. So, 2003, U.S. comes in, provisional government, Iraqi constitution in 2005. I actually covered this constitution on Max and the Wiz in 2005, and I think I actually read it through. Yeah, I was that much of an overachiever.
Were they borrowing heavily from the U.S. constitution, and it was...
No, it was a mess.
Several pages, or was this like an EU, European Union constitution, where it's like 5,000 pages and all sorts of heretofore unknown rights.
It's a Middle Eastern constitution, but you can guess which one I think it's more closer to. It was a long document. All right. So they had this election on October 10th, and negotiations on who's forming the government are happening now, along with some civil unrest, which, you know, is not too uncommon. But that's another thing that's a little different. Even, you know, this is true in most European countries, where after the election, they
have to build a governing coalition.
Exactly.
Assuming they don't have a naked majority.
Right, right. Yeah. And usually in some countries, this is an easy process. Actually, this would happen in the United States if we had lots of little parties. And it might have happened once or twice where there's a coalition. I'm not sure.
It's but debatable like, whether a more than two-party system is feasible given the structural nature right. of our system. But yes, if there was.
I think it has. That would be a really interesting thing to check. Like, has it happened in U.S. history where either the House of Representatives or the Senate didn't have a majority? I mean, there was recently where, like, you know, there were two independents, but they were basically Democrats. Yeah. But but maybe there was some negotiating. And of course, it's not who forms the government in our case. It's just who's the majority leader. So it's less consequential. Whereas there, the majority leader is the government. So
I think there is some of that goes on, but it gets more or less brushed under the rug because it all comes down to, okay, which party do you caucus with? So
right.
like there are what is it? Is it Minnesota where it's not actually the Democratic Party? It's like the Democratic the Democrat and Farmer Party of Minnesota.
I never understood that.
But they always caucus with the Democrats. Yeah. So it's kind of a distinction without a difference. And similarly with some of the independents, you know, you more or less know who they're going to caucus with, and you can functionally write them off as being a member of one of the two parties, even if they're technically either an independent or belonging to a third party.
The Farmer Labor Party sounds like such an anachronism. I feel like I should just start the like steampunk party. that would actually be.
You might be able to get some seats in the New Hampshire.
I could imagine the. Oh yeah, well, the New Hampshire State House is also very interesting in this regard. Okay, but
well, so
we're talking about coalitions and how in some cases, so in different countries it works different. So in the U.S., it's like. No, basically one party has the majority most of the time. Then you have countries like...
Although that does come into play with anything that requires a filibuster-proof vote
Or a majority. No, yeah, but I'm just talking about...
coalitions, but it's not in the sense of, you know, forming a government.
Right, okay. Yeah. But I'm just talking about, right, forming a government. Then you have countries, the way I see it, like Canada and the UK, where occasionally there's coalitions, but they happen pretty fast. Like... usually within a few days, because there's like, you know, usually a major party and then they've got to deal with a minor one. Then you've got like right now, like Germany had kind of a split result and they had negotiations for very long.
Israel has fairly recently elections had some close calls on that.
That's the most amazing kind of recent example because they had the largest party, which Likud party, which had, you know, maybe a quarter, but they couldn't form a majority. And the only way another coalition could come about was to combine six parties that are like completely opposed on many issues other than they agree that, you know, they want a change in government. So there's also horse trading. Now from this article that I read in Chatham House, are saying that in Iraq, you know, the government formation doesn't seem to a lot of outside observers to have much correlation with how much people, how many seats these parties win. It seems like they kind of trade ministries and portfolios along sectarian lines, and it's hard to predict who will be in the government from the seat allocations. And so... this article describes this as a problem. I suspect there's a bit of pragmatism in that as well. So they kind of rely on grand coalitions.
Yeah, that's very reminiscent of, and again, I might be mixing this up because this is not my area of expertise, but I think Lebanon may have a system where it's maybe a little bit more set in stone, but something like the prime minister will always be from this particular ethnicity, and the president will be from this other ethnicity.
They do exactly
that. And you know, these seats in the ministry are allocated to this particular group, and exactly how they make that work in and still call it a democracy is something I'm by no means up to speed on. But there's some divisions there that are, it's not purely done by the numbers on the vote turnout.
I think that it makes sense. Given what we said before, that these are, you know, there's a lot of different groups in order to, you know, have the stability, you know, and I sort of felt like it came off weird when I was talking about the Electoral College last year, about how, hey, you know, we have an Electoral College to divide power among the states, whereas, you know, some of these Middle Eastern countries, they have special considerations for certain minority groups. Maybe that's a way to, you know, ensure, I mean, on the surface, it's like kind of a way to ensure that like certain groups don't get drowned out. So it almost sounds like it could be a good thing.
Yeah,
but
it locks in certain balances, I think.
And also maybe gives legitimacy to the government, because otherwise, you know, they could say, well, you know, this government doesn't speak to me. It's this other group that.
Well, the problem, as it's been explained to me with that system, for example, in Lebanon, is that so the you know, how many seats go to which ethnic group is based on census data, but they haven't had a legitimate census in like 50 years, and so it's almost certain that the breakdown does not reflect the actual breakdown of the population, but the entrenched powers have no incentive to rewrite those books, so to speak.
Right.
But we're straying off the topic. So let's get back to Iraq. I had a question on so we're talking about representation in their parliamentary body. Are they a unicameral or bicameral system? Do they have just a
I believe the it's equivalent unicameral.
Of House of Reps, or do they also have like a Senate type body that is based on a different mathematics?
Let me look at Iraqi Senate. There is a Senate of Iraq.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, no. It was. This was under this was under the kingdom. The senators were appointed by the king. Okay. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And overthrown in 1958. Yeah. So I think it's just this one parliament. But again, like I said, it's not like there's a majority ruling coalition. They kind of form this grand coalition where everyone kind of trades.
I'm very aware that that's kind of how it's done in many democracies around the world, but it feels so foreign here in the U.S. because, you know, we have enough drama with election results themselves. But if then, okay, even if every election is called on that first Tuesday in November, and on that Wednesday we know the results, but we didn't know what the actual government being formed was still, that was, you know, a new process that had to happen, and especially if it takes on the order of months to get negotiated out, that's kind of mind-blowing.
Let me show you how weird this is. So I looked up the election of Iraq and of 2018, the previous one, and then who became the prime minister. And so I was like, okay, here's the election results.
Are they on a regular cycle, or is it, I know in some parliamentary systems, they can like call for an election kind of at whim.
I read about this. Yes, they can call for an election at whim, but it's unclear when they can. There's still, but we don't have to get into that.
Okay, sorry.
So no, this is what I was going to say.
This is a regularly scheduled election.
Right, 2018, they had an election. And so I go on the Wikipedia page and you could see the list of parties, and there's like a lot of them, like all these faces of people and the number of seats they won and the party. And then when you scroll down and you see who becomes prime minister, he's not on that list of faces above. And not only that, the party that it's listed for the prime minister is not on the party list from above. So there's all, and a lot of them are from, so like, you know, a lot of the so-called parties are coalitions of other parties and form coalitions. So there's a lot of moving pieces. Well, again, I didn't have time to dive into all of this before
Israel
the show.
Just recently that the Israeli, was it prime minister, was from like the smallest party in the coalition.
Yes, but he was still one of the parties.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and I actually understand how that happened a lot better, than what's going on.
It kind of makes me think of some of conspiracy theory, takes that, well, if the Republicans take back the House of Representatives, they could appoint Donald Trump to be Speaker of the House, because technically the Speaker doesn't have to be elected to the House. And that's, yeah, you get into some weird conditions with that. So I can imagine a world where the prime minister is not of the majority party and not even of a party. If somehow they have enough pull and enough weight that there's something else they're bringing to the table.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's...
Well, I guess, and I'm going to go ahead and Godwin the argument right here.
Yeah. By the way, we're 20 minutes in. We haven't even talked about the two systems.
I don't think Adolf Hitler was actually elected to office. I think his party gained control of the Reichstag, and then they appointed him chancellor. But I could be wrong on that. Don't hold me to it.
I think he was the party leader, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Iraq.
Right, right. Okay, so now we get to talk about voting systems, which you haven't, it's been 20 minutes into this. Oh, I think we keep saying that we're not
before
experts.
Before we get there, let me throw one thing out.
Hold on. Before you throw your one thing out, I want to throw one thing out.
We more tangents.
Yes, we keep saying we're not experts in this, and yet we just got into it, and we seem to know a heck of a lot. So we seem to be kind of able to figure this out.
I can take a topic and run with it. It doesn't mean anything I'm saying makes sense.
But. No. We seem to know a lot more than the average person. We're comparing ourselves to, like, if you're a scholar in comparative electoral systems.
We're not ready for punditry prime time yet.
Are you kidding me? We know a lot more than, like, the people on cable news on this stuff.
This isn't the point I was going to make, but I was reading some of our reference material for this, I was thinking, well, on the plus side, the people reporting on this are not going to be like they don't necessarily have a dog in the fight. They're not going to be steeped in partisan bias like you might expect from some of the news outlets here in the U.S. reporting on our elections. So surely they're going to be a more objective. But then I thought better of that and thought, well, what are their sources for where they're getting the information on this? And so either they're going to be woefully ill-informed or they're going to be working off of sources which would have those partialities, those biases. So we're synthesizing from the best data we have available, but without having literal boots on the ground to know about this, it's tricky to make sense of it at that kind of degree.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So should I get into it? What's their old system and what's their new system now that we've been talking about this for 20 minutes?
Yeah, I'm going to leave the other tangent on the cutting room floor.
Okay, sure. Well, now I'm curious. Now you can't just withhold this from me.
Oh, okay, fine. So
just make it quick, all right?
Yeah, we were talking about coalitions. And I don't know I can't remember if it was the Netherlands or maybe it was Denmark, but I feel like within the last decade, there was a country in the European Union that did not form a government for like two straight years because they had an election and they just could not form a majority coalition. And so they
might have been
had
Denmark
like
or Sweden.
Yeah, they had like a caretaker government that ran for, I think it was nearly 2 years before they formed a government. And yeah, a couple months of negotiating, this sounds bad, but can you imagine if we didn't have a new government from election results in the U.S. and it just kind of coasted for 2 years?
No. I guess the presidential system kind of makes that difficult to imagine. Although if you had thrown into the House, okay, let's not even get into it. We know way too much about elections around the world, don't we?
Too much for our own good.
Yeah, I didn't know how much we knew about this stuff. Okay, the old system in Iraq. So this is
post-2005 constitution, pre-recent rule change.
Right. So they have 18 provinces, and basically each province is a constituency. Each province is an electoral district. So provinces are allocated seats beforehand, and each one has an election that I think is based on proportional representation. So I think you vote for a party within the province. And then, you know, let's say the province is allocated 100 seats. I'm just doing that, making it easy. No province has 100 seats because they only have like a certain number of, they probably have like 400 seats or so. And they're like, you know, no province is that big. But let's say you have 100 seats and your party gets 25% of the vote in that province, you get 25 seats. Now, there is a question of, and this will get into our topic at the end, there's a question of what method you use to allocate the seats based on the vote. And like you were saying before, it sounds like it should be very simple, right?
Yeah, were we talking about this off the air?
Yeah.
What's written in, like, for example, in the U.S. Constitution, it's like three lines that talks right. about the apportionment of representation. It right. should be super simple.
Right.
But then when you actually go to do it, there's some nuance.
Right. Right. And we're also talking about this on two levels, right? Because first of all, there's allocating seats to provinces. And then the second level, it's allocating seats within a province to parties given the vote for that party. So,
right. So allocating seats to the provinces would happen on, well, to use the U.S. as an example, happens every decade when they update the census.
Yeah.
They update that. I'm sure they have a relatively similar system there. Whereas within the provinces, every election, you have to allocate yeah. seats based on proportionality.
Except, you know, there are certain seats set aside for ethnic groups, certain seats set aside for women. But let's put that aside for now. I think that remains in the new one. So there are a bunch of methods then for dealing with, because you're never going to get an exact, like, hey, 25% of the votes, 25 seats out of 100. It's never going to work out that cleanly. There's always going to be some fractions. And so how to allocate those fractions is what's very difficult. And it could actually mean a lot because, you know, a lot of elections are selected between a few percentage points, and who gets those fractional seats is...
especially when you're looking at smaller numbers. If you have, you know, 100 seats in this district to divvy up, not so big. But if you're looking at, you know, how do you divide up six seats... the remainders become much more, not chaotic, but
yeah.
there's a lot more riding on that, yeah. that so small difference.
So I'm going to put that aside to the end because okay. we're going to talk more about that video from Matt Parker at the end. So let's get into the new system now. So the new system, first of all, they switched it from 18 provinces to 83 constituencies. I don't know if they're gerrymandered. Probably not. They're probably, I don't know. It's probably more of an American thing. And seats are now reserved for women in specific minority groups. Additionally, and those constituencies are no longer done through proportional representation. They're done through a single non-transferable vote. So instead of voting for a party, you're now voting for an individual person. And if your constituency has eight seats, the top eight vote getters go in. So this is somewhat, it's going to end up being somewhat proportional, but the difference is that now you need to think about voting strategically a lot more than you did before. So if there's an example, let's use the example, there are eight seats in your district, right? You want to try to vote for someone who's just on the cusp of being in eighth or ninth place. Because if you vote for someone who has way more votes than they need, you're not really helping them. Yeah,
this seems tricky, especially
right.
like it's simple. If your party has one contender, then everybody can stack up behind them.
Right.
But if you think your party is going to have like six out of the eight seats, how do you distribute those votes so that you don't have 90% yeah. of your voters going to the one top vote getter and then you miss out on
so
other seats?
I think the idea is to take focus off the party and put focus on the individual. Mm. But yeah, so again, you're trying to vote for someone who's on the cusp of eighth or ninth place. Otherwise, you're throwing away your vote. If you're voting for someone who's too far down, you're not doing anything. If you vote for someone who's too far up, you're not doing anything. And then it seems like if everybody does that, then the top vote getters start to equalize.
Yeah, there's a lot of game theory
right.
Here.
So,
and I'm curious how much and how accurate their polling is for
yeah.
for how do you gauge this?
Right, exactly. There's probably not accurate voting in the United States. I doubt.
Well, yeah, especially when you get down to like the House level in the U.S., polling is
yeah
low reliability.
So you think you can you can figure this out if you're in Iraq? I know I couldn't, and so I wanted to see what the cutoffs were. I couldn't like find the data on that, but I think it's a problem. You could see all the candidates kind of go into about equal. It's sort of like the same problem in a single constituency where the two big parties become about equal. But now you have it with eight people. And then, you know, it seems like the problem is that they're going to be about equal. And then, I feel like it could be very, like, it could change completely on a whim who gets in and who doesn't get in. It can almost seem random at times. So that's one issue that that I see. Now, the result is that in the parliament, Muqtada al-Sadr increased his lead. Now, if you've been alive in the U.S. for a while, you might remember that name. He was the, what was
it,
he called?
Is it
the,
his father that that is the name we're familiar with?
No,
or,
him.
Or is this the man in himself?
He okay. was, so he was in, he was opposing the U.S. In 2003, 2004. I don't remember exactly what it, like were they actively fighting the U.S. or was it more, because I don't remember like.
I remember hearing about Sadr City.
Right.
But I can't put it in context.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So anyway, he was very young when that was happening. So he was like in his 30s. So he's still around. He's going to be around for a while. But he still might not be in the governing coalition or his party because his number of seats are like well short of the majority. Like still is 20%.
So you were saying he has the plurality. They're the largest party.
Yeah.
But not enough to govern on their own. And so I guess, it'll come down to who can marshal the strongest coalition there.
Right, right. I mean, but again, they're not really, I think I read something saying that he is considering, or his party is considering going to a more coalition-based system where he's like, okay, we're the leading party and we're gonna form a majority government, but now I think it's back to that whole horse trading among everyone thing.
Sure.
So his party is a Shiite party. We all learned this. Iraq has Shiite, Sunni, and Kurds. In actuality, it's got a lot more groups than that. I believe the Shiites in Iraq form the majority. Yeah, but still,
I used to know the difference between those groups, but it has escaped me.
Yeah. No. It's still. It's like. It's still like very unclear what's going to happen. But his coalition supported the law and it seems like they did benefit from it. Although, they got 73 seats and it's up from 54. Now it could just be like changes in voter preferences, but I don't know. We still don't know what's going to happen and it would be interesting to see if this system, which seems extremely complicated and insane, but most electoral systems do, if you're coming in from the outside, I'm sure ours does.
Especially if you drill down a little bit
And
get past the top level. Yeah, there's a lot of gears involved.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's basically what's happening. So now everybody who's listening to this knows more about this whole change in election law in Iraq than probably all your friends, so you can be thankful for that. We definitely want to get into how seats are allocated fractionally, but before we do it, is there anything else? Is there anything else you want to say about like Iraq in particular?
I don't have any context for how this would potentially impact us here in America. I don't know that that's really been an angle that we've read up on. It's much more of interest from the perspective of kind of election procedure and the math behind it, I think, to us at this point. But
right.
But I'm sure there'll be interesting repercussions on the region as a whole, given what the new government form there looks like.
Yeah. Okay. So. Along with this, we watched the video called The Alabama Paradox with Matt Parker of Stand Up Math. And this is related to what's going on in Iraq, but it's also related to, arguments that were occurring early on in the United States about how to allocate seats to states, which is also the same problem of how to allocate seats to parties in a proportional system. The problem is, what do you do about these fractional seats? And, the obvious thing to do is, just round them. Maybe just round up the ones that are closest to the next number and round down the other ones that are not as close until you have the right number. Turns out that's actually leads to some crazy results. One is called the Alabama paradox, where it's like, okay, let's suppose you add one more seat to Congress. Then you're like, okay, great. Some state will get that seat.
That would seem entirely logical.
No, it turns out that sometimes one state will get that seat, but another state might have to give up a seat to a third state. And you're like, what, how the heck could that occur? But it's because those fractional bits, those fractions of a seat, it actually changes like who's at 0.9 and who's at 0.1. Because when you add another seat, that denominator on dividing a population by seats just changes completely. So that could really have a lot of repercussions. And this was discovered in 1880 with the census, where they added more seats and Alabama lost a seat, not because they lost population, but because...
Yeah, they actually had an increase in... I don't know if they had the largest increase in population percentage-wise, but they had a significant increase,
right?
Even relative to the rest of the country.
Yeah.
And yet lost seats, which seems like it shouldn't happen.
Right, and it's not just common. It turns out under a lot of these schemes, it's actually very... I said it's not just common. It's not just possible. It's actually very common. So, you know, there are a bunch of different ways to do this. He went through a few. One is like the Jefferson rule, the Hamilton rule, the Adams rule. So basically he laid out two kind of things that we want to avoid. It turns out you can't avoid both of them. Those always happen in mathematical elections. I'm thinking, of course, of the arrows impossibility theorem. But here's another one.
I'm sure that it's possible to have a case where neither of those happen, but not a system that will...
Where they can't happen.
Where you can be guaranteed not to have one or the other.
Right, right. So one, you want to avoid the Alabama paradox. And two, you want to follow the quota rule, which is that, let's say there are 100 seats and I have... 19.5% of the population. Well, I should either get 19 seats or 20 seats. I shouldn't get 21 seats. I shouldn't get 18 seats. I should either be one ahead or one before.
Right. It stands to reason you should be able to round up or down by one, but not by more.
Yeah. So it turns out you can't you can't satisfy both of them all the time. But it's still the case that some systems are better than others. So I'm going to link to that YouTube video if you want to get more into the mathematics of how these systems work. So they usually revolve around the quotients of population to seats to get that extra seat. And sometimes the quotient changes as you're allocating seats. That's kind of what we do now. It's like one seat is allocated to each state, and then there's a formula for basically who is the next state to get a seat with some quotient comes in, and then once they get that seat, okay, now their denominator is higher, so their quotient is lower. So then some other state gets the next seat, and it's just allocated one by one, which is kind of nice because it's easy to calculate. And so this is the current method, the Hill method. And in general, they had the Jefferson method from the early on, which actually makes it more likely that bigger states are going to get more representation. And then, like, you know, you had the Hamilton method where smaller states got more representation. And I don't know if this was part of those guys' political philosophy or if they were just like, hey, I've got an idea, but I suspect there was something behind that.
Yeah. Well, and this is, there's an additional wrinkle to
Virginia
be considered
was big.
Here.
Yeah.
That you could potentially make an argument for or against the, you know, favoring larger states versus favoring smaller states in the context of also having the Senate, which inherently favors smaller states, and that representation in the Senate is independent of population.
Right. So anyway,
but not all, but a unicameral system wouldn't necessarily have that element. And so, you know, a solution that might be justifiable for the U.S. system may not be as readily applicable to the Iraqi system if we were trying to apply
right.
it there.
So the Iraqi system now is using the, or was it using? It was using the Webster method in the old one. And this was adopted in 1842 in the United States. It was from Daniel Webster, one of our politicians here. And it lasted until 1940, until he had the current method. And so basically it was based on kind of successive quotients, and that method sort of, as opposed to the Jefferson method, it was one of the ones that gave small states a slight edge. Now, interestingly, the current method that we use, obviously, I think it avoids the Alabama paradox and makes the quota paradox less likely. So you can, even though you can't avoid them completely, you could make these things less likely,
which is
always the answer to everything. Like even in computer science, when like something is not, you can't calculate something in a reasonable amount of time, you always step back and say, can I estimate it in a reasonable amount of time? And then the answer is almost always yes. So,
yeah, this may seem a little abstract because, you know, when are we going to be adding seats? But we are reapportioning those seats every 10 years due to the census. That's part of the redistricting,
well, it's
which
a big
I guess
deal.
We're in the midst of now.
It's a big deal when a state loses a seat and gains a seat. And that's, you know.
It is not out of the realm of possibility for additional states to be admitted to the union.
Right.
Puerto Rico and D.C. have in recent years been discussed, or perhaps for states to split in some way. I mean, it hasn't happened in recent memory, but it has happened before.
Or to leave the union entirely.
Well, yeah, I guess that would be a little bit different. Would we keep it at, you know, if let's say, I'm going to use Vermont as an example because they maintain that they have the right to secede since they were the first they were the 14th state. They were not an original colony. So of course they have the right to leave. They had the right to join. So let's say Vermont gets a hair and decides to depart. So do they take their seats with them? Do we reduce from 438 seats in the House, or do we just divvy those seats among the rest of the states after they've departed?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's set in stone now. When thinking about this whole allocation thing, I was always wondering, like, wouldn't you want to say, like, hey, you get X number of seats for every X, Y population, and then maybe the number of seats floats, it goes up and down after each census. But then I feel like they adjust the number, and so maybe, you know,
yeah,
I don't know.
That would certainly... It would help address the apportionment problem in that respect, that you wouldn't be so concerned with the Alabama problem or the quota problem,
right?
But it would mean that, you know, basically if they recalculate every 10 years, then every decade, the presidential electoral college math would change.
Right.
Because that would be fluctuating.
Well, it already changes.
Very interesting. I mean, so it moves around, but it wouldn't be 538 necessarily.
Oh, right, yeah.
The totals would change.
And then 538 blog would be obsolete, or they'd have to change their name every 10 years.
I guess the other piece of that, and not to get too deep down into the math, because it was a Matt Parker video is very worth watching, even though it is a little on the long side.
Right.
He mentions that in the 1800s, as laid out in the Constitution, there's this benchmark of 30,000 people per representative.
Right.
Which I believe we have removed or invalidated that part, because we certainly don't maintain that ratio with our current scheme.
No, well, it's actually, you can't have more than that. But the problem is, we have way more than that. And, it was kind of expected that a representative would maybe be 50,000 people, but now we have in some cases almost a million people, which, changes the nature of that election.
And if you were to actually use the 30,000 as the benchmark, then the House would be enormous.
Yeah.
And you think it's ineffective now with 438 people. Imagine increasing that by an order of magnitude or more.
Yeah, I mean, it depends, because it would also be like, you know, you'd probably have to take a lot more votes rather than actually ask. Like the party leadership would probably just have to take votes to find out whether something passed or not, rather than ask everyone, because that might not be feasible. No, I thought about that. I actually think there's some good good reasons to have a huge representative body in that way, mainly because I think it would get it could get money out of the elections in kind of a clean way. I don't know if that it would work, but like, hey, you know, in New Hampshire, for example, the state house is very small constituencies, so anyone can run, anyone can win. Whereas to run for Congress of the United States, it kind of takes you have usually have to have some big groups backing you. There are some exceptions, but it's sort of it's sort of almost contributed to the ossification, I guess, of our political system. So, but again, I'm not saying go do it. I don't know what a 10,000 person Congress would be like.
I'm getting flashes of the Galactic Senate.
Yeah. Well, you know, you could say, look how that worked out, but didn't that last for 1,000 years?
So they say.
So they say. All right. Just to make sure that the Sith don't come along. All right. I feel like we definitely had a theme today. What do you think is the main takeaway of today's podcast episode?
Even things that seem like they're simple and not math oriented are extremely complex and have math at the core of them.
Yeah. I also think that, you know, I do think that there is something that we can learn from what's happened. Obviously in Iraq, you have conditions for, a democratic republic that are, let's say, less than ideal as compared to maybe the United States. But I feel like there's still a lot to learn from it. And there's a lot of like takeaways in terms of like, you know, what's going on there. And so I'm going to watch this very closely. Social choice theory is full of really surprising results. And then elections in the real world also introduce tons of complications in addition to that. So it's such a that's why it's such a fascinating topic.
Well, and yeah, the countries like Iraq and their situation, people talk about how polarized and divisive we are here in the US, but they literally have different ethnic groups who in the past have been at each other's throats, and they're attempting to find a way to coexist there. And so maybe it's worth watching to see what we can, you know, maybe not to replicate what they're doing, but what we can take away from that to
we can learn either good or bad, or maybe some things that don't apply. But, you know, yeah, I agree.
So, yeah, no matter what, there are lessons to be learned. You just got to make sure you're taking away the right ones.
All right. I think this is a cool discussion. I think we got into a lot of things that, you know, people wouldn't otherwise hear about. This certainly wasn't on the news. I don't care what you watch. If you watch Fox News or MSNBC or CNN or go on Twitter, I don't think this was on there. So we brought something new. All right. I think we're good to go. Are you good to go?
I
you ready to adjourn?
I have nothing new to add to this.
All right.
I second the motion to adjourn.
All right. Great. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.